Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Got leaves? All of Vermont does at this time of year. And today, Vermont Edition will bring you the broadcast version of a listicle, five things you can do with leaves. Spoiler alert, none of them involve stuffing a pair of pants and a shirt, popping a pumpkin and a hat on top, and turning it into a scary Halloween person. Unless you make it look like Charlie Nardozzi, then it's all okay. But speaking about composting leaves probably won't take up a full hour, so we will talk about other gardening things too. I mean, we can't waste the time we've been given with gardening guru Charlie Nardozzi, now can we? And as I've already told you, gardening guru and gardening consultant and host of the Vermont Garden Journal here on VPR, Charlie Nardozzi is with us today. Charlie, nice to have you out of the garden and in the studio for the day.
Yes, even though it's a really nice day out there.
Oh, it's been a series of nice days. I know a lot of people who spent all weekend in their garden because it was such a beautiful time. I mean, sometimes in October, your hands are frozen as you're trying to plant the garlic or get the shrubs out. And not this weekend.
Not this weekend. It's been really beautiful. We had that little cold spell that killed a bunch of things in different parts of the state. But then, as it often happens, it got warm again, and it's been beautiful. And it's going to continue to be beautiful, probably above freezing for another week or so. So
what should people do?
Keep gardening.
But keep gardening how?
Oh, there's so much to do. This is my second busiest time of year. First, of course, being May. But October is a very busy time of year because you can still be planting a lot of things, not only the ones that you mentioned with the garlic and the shallots and the spring flowering bulbs, but you can be getting sales on perennial flowers, trees, shrubs. All those things can still be planted. Many of those, the perennials like the trees and shrubs, their roots continue to grow even down to 40 degrees when the soil is at 40 degrees.
So which takes longer than the air temperature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That could be November, sometimes even December, depending on where you are in the state. So if you can get those plants in now, they'll have a good month or two to really get established so that they will be ready to go come next spring.
But should you? I mean, shouldn't you have done that? Should you have done it earlier, ideally?
Well,
so this
Jane,
is for the procrastinators among us?
October 14th. The should-haves is long gone.
I mean, I count myself among the people who are usually very late. I have planted garlic in November,
yes,
and it's still come
it still
up
works.
Fine.
I planted tulips in December.
Charlie.
Actually had to break the frost off the soil, put them in, they flowered the next year. That does not mean you should wait. I'm not giving you an excuse to wait till December.
But if there's some reason that you have to, you may be okay.
Yes, if you find that little brown bag in the bottom of the closet and it's, oh, those are the daffodils I was supposed to plant 2 months ago, you can still put them in the ground.
Only in Charlie Nardozzi's house is that brown bag in the bottom of the closet probably full of daffodil bulbs, but we'll let that go for now.
Right.
All right, so there are some things that got killed in the recent cold weather, and some people have had, I think, a hard frost already.
Yes.
But there's also a lot still growing. I mean, in my neck of the woods in Addison County, there's really good corn right now. So what are people actually still coming up through their garden with that because of that late growing season and because it's been pretty warm this fall, you might still either be seeing in your farmer's market or at the roadside stand or in your own garden?
Yeah, any of the cool season vegetables. I usually plant a lot of things that are going to mature September, October, and November because I've experienced this now year after year. We have really beautiful falls here. Don't let anyone know. But they're really beautiful falls. So you get nice temperatures. You might get a freeze, but if you can protect plants, you're okay. But the plants I'm talking about, you don't even need to protect. So things like the Brussels sprouts, the cabbages, the fall cauliflowers, fall peas, any of the leafy greens from kale to Swiss chard to arugula to spinach, all those things are going to continue to grow and really love this weather. So you can have these right up until it really gets so absolute cold that they're going to have to die back.
But anything else you're surprised about? I've been surprised by how good the sweet corn is even into October, that we usually, that's not the season we expect, but everything got planted pretty late.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Everything, the whole season kind of got shifted ahead because we had to plant really late due to the cool, wet spring that we had. So a lot of the things that normally would be maturing in September are kind of maturing in October. It's also working in the same way with things that normally we maturing in October are getting a little late. So the winter squashes, for example, you know, there are certainly winter squashes out there, but the big harvest of them maybe is a little bit delayed because it's took a while for them to get going, get pollinated, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. If you have a question for Charlie Nardozzi, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. George in Northfield emailed in to say, I've harvested some butternut nuts, and I was wondering what would be the best way to grow them. Should I let them freeze over the winter?
Oh, so he wants to grow them from the nuts themselves. Yeah, they'll need some kind of a chilling period. If you can think about how butternuts normally would grow, they will drop to the ground. They'll sit all winter on the cold, damp ground. That's the conditions you want to recreate. So if you can put them in a refrigerator, maybe with a little potting soil, a little moisture in there, so kind of a slightly dampened potting soil, and leave them through the winter. Usually, you know, they may not need the whole period, but there's no harm in leaving them in there until April or so. If he's in Northfield, maybe May, depending upon the snow levels. And then you could try to grow them. I would try to germinate them inside first. I wouldn't just try to pop them into the ground. So take them out of the bag in a warm place, try to grow them up. Once you get them to germinate and they're starting to really start grow, then you can put them outside where you like them.
Okay. And butternut trees are among the trees that have really suffered over the years. Butternut canker, I remember doing a story on almost a decade ago now. So if George even plants them, is that a good idea to try? I mean, I know that scientists have been working on butternuts to try to find a blight resistant variety. But if George plants his butternuts, still worth a shot?
It's worth a shot. I mean, you never know what varieties will actually come up as far as a sport or a mutation that might be there that might turn out to be a resistant one. But it's still going to be a good thing to do to have those trees out there. Even if they never reach the maturing age, they're still going to be good for the environment to have.
All right, let's go to Veronica, who's calling in from Bethlehem, New Hampshire. Hi, Veronica.
Hi. I am calling because we're about the same latitude as St. Johnsbury, and I'm wondering if I can still plant garlic in a raised bed, and should I maybe mulch it in with some leaf mulch?
Yes, this is absolutely the time to do it. In fact, if you have nothing else to do today, go plant your garlic. You can plant garlic even in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, mid-October into the end of October, as long as the ground isn't getting too cold, which it hasn't yet. And in a raised bed is a great place to grow it because garlic grows very well, and the only thing I've ever seen that will kill garlic is cold, wet soil. So if you have it on the ground and it get a lot of snow and then it melts in the spring and it stays cold and wet, that'll rot those cloves. A raised bed solves that problem because you're raising it up, you get better soil drainage. So put those garlic bulbs in there, plant them down a couple inches deep, maybe 4 or 6 inches apart. Remember, each one of those cloves is going to turn into a bulb. So don't do what I did the first year, which is like, oh, I'll just plant like 5 or 10 bulbs of garlic, which turned into like 50 or 60 bulbs of garlic.
Yeah, that. Does it even grow? I mean, does it all grow up in one? Wouldn't that make it problematic?
Oh, separating them out. So if you separate them out, you end up getting a lot of garlic. And then what are you going to do? I mean, I love garlic, but really, that's a lot of garlic. So grow as much as you really are realistically going to eat, but leave a little extra for your seed stock for next year. And that's a nice way to continue to grow this variety that will eventually become Veronica's variety because it'll get adapted to your soil, your weather conditions, and that's how varieties start being bred.
All right, so Stephen in Reading says, what should I do with my perennial flowers for winter? These include Shasta daisies, lupin, cornflower, hollyhocks, foxglove, and lilies.
So there's been kind of a change in thinking a little bit around taking care of the perennial flowers that you have. The old idea behind it was that you'd always come in this time of year, and as soon as things start turning a little yellow, you just come back and you just cut it all down to the ground. Just kind of do a big, almost like a mowing, cutting everything back, all the herbaceous perennials, only the herbaceous ones, not the woody ones, and cleaning it all up that way. And the idea was that you're removing all this material that could have diseases in it, insects on it, to kind of clean it up. And I think there's an aesthetic that people kind of like to look out at their perennial flower garden, seeing it all cut back. And it's like, okay, now I can go sit back and read the magazine or whatever, the book I haven't read all summer. But the thinking has gone full circle, and now more and more the recommendations are to leave things, certain things, first of all. Certain plants are very good for wildlife into the fall and even into the winter. So you get some seed heads, like with echinacea and rudbeckias, for example, even things like teasel. These all have seeds that you'll watch the goldfinches and the little chickadees go after, and they're just going to be pecking away at them well into November and December. So you want to leave some of those out there. But beyond just the birds, the idea that you're leaving leaving some of the plant material there is also helping a lot of the microorganisms that'll overwinter. The fear was that the other things that would overwinter are all the bad guys, but all the good guys overwinter too, you know? So you got to have a space for both of them. So now what's more and more recommended is to, if you are going to cut them back, cut like to a chop and drop. Chop them down, drop them, just leave them there. Leave it, kind of imagine what a forest looks like. You know, it always has the leaves on it, the branches, all the dead materials just on the forest floor. Try to do the same thing with your perennial flower garden. Now, that being said, if you had a really big infestation of some kind of insect or some kind of unusual disease, and I say unusual, I mean not the powdery mildews, for example. They're just always around. Then you might want to remove those plants. But for everything else, as long as you're okay aesthetically with it, cut it, drop it, just leave it there in the garden. It's going to insulate the root system, especially of those tender perennials, more tender perennials. It's going to provide cover for a lot of the insects and the creatures that are in the ground. And by spring, it's all going to decompose and up comes a new crop of flowers.
So is that true even for things like daylilies, which turn brown and kind of, you know, stocky, but I often don't get around to them until they're starting to come up again in the spring, or hostas, you know, where you're like, oh, God, I got to do something about that.
Yeah, those plants are really tough plants. So you could even just leave them like you have done intentionally.
I mean, yeah. Aesthetically, I would say it's probably not the most attractive, but also then you come back in, you know, March and you get rid of them all and they're all pretty much kind of deteriorating. They're easy to clean up.
Exactly. Easy to clean up and they all can decompose. And if you left them a little longer, they would just disappear and the new foliage would come through. So if you're okay with the look of it, which is going to be a little more of a messy look in the garden, it's probably better ecologically for your garden to do it that way.
Same with rhubarb, because I know with rhubarb you want to leave a little rhubarb around, but then at the end of the season when it's starting to look really grody, do you get rid of it or leave it?
You could do either one of them, but the idea is to leave it in place. The whole idea is to not get into this extra work of taking everything out of your garden, put it in a compost pile, make it into compost, then put it back onto your garden. Why do this
compost
work?
In place.
Compost in place, exactly.
All right, let's go to Janice, who's calling in from Newport. Janice, hi, go right ahead.
Hi, I have a miniature rosebush that I got from my son from North Carolina. Growing season is 7, so it was in the garden for the summertime, and we just dug it up and put it in the house in a pot. I'm wondering how to take care of it over the winter. And my second question is how to take care of Bleeding Heart and Tomatis that's planted out in the garden side.
Janice, your phone line is not quite up to pot, so tell us again the last thing that you're trying to look for, the two plants that are still outside.
The Clematis and Bleeding Heart.
Okay, so Clematis and Bleeding Heart are outside. How should she care for those over the winter? And what about the rosebush that's been potted and brought inside?
Right, the Zone 7 rosebush. That's important to know because obviously it won't survive outside. So if it's all potted up, the rosebush, I would leave it outside till the leaves drop, till it starts getting cold. Don't let it get down to freezing, but certainly the next month or so, you probably could just leave it out in a protected spot. So it can handle a hard frost, right. What it can't handle is our absolute cold temperatures. So when it gets down to 0 or minus 10, minus 20, that's when it's really going to suffer. But you don't even want it to get that far because it's in a container, and if it even gets down to 20 degrees, that could really kill the roots because it is in a pot that doesn't have a lot of soil. But for the next month or so, we're probably going to be okay, and it starts getting it into its dormancy. Once that's happened, hopefully she has a cool basement or a cool place where she can put it, or maybe an unheated garage that stays relatively warm, somewhere where it stays around freezing, basically, is what we're looking for. Or maybe if it's in a basement up into the 40s, where you can just leave it for the winter. Just keep the pot down there in the winter. It could be in the dark. It's not going to do anything. It's just going to stay dormant because it's cool. As soon as its biological clock starts ticking, usually March or April, depending upon how warm it is where it is, then it'll start leafing out. And at that point, you probably have to bring it up into a window somewhere to give it some light. But again, a cool room is good because it'll slow down the growth. And then hopefully by May, you can put it back outside again.
So you can't like put it next to your fireplace and have nice roses all winter?
That's a great idea, but it's not going to happen.
All right, fine.
The Bleeding Hearts and Clematis are a lot easier because they are hardy. The Bleeding Hearts, just like we were talking about with rhubarb and hostas, you can just let the leaves, well, they're probably already gone, actually. They're probably not even there anymore. So you can maybe clean it up a little bit if you want to, but it really isn't anything to do. They're a hardy perennial, come back pretty consistently every year, unless they're in a really wet spot, then they might rot. The Clematis is kind of similar to that. You don't want to do any cutting or pruning back of the Clematis until the spring. and that's a late winter, spring. And you'll do that to kind of clean it up, cut back to some buds on some of the biggest stalks that are coming up so you get some nice, healthy branching coming out next spring, which will give you more flowers.
Charlie, you know, speaking of rose bushes, you and I have had this conversation before, but I cannot get rid of one rose bush that I do not like. I do not want it next to my house. I dig that thing up every year, and every year it comes back, I really believe, just to spite me. There are a few plants like that that I know are doing this on purpose to me. And I can't get rid of it.
They're helping build character.
What do I do? But other than bulldoze the entire front of my house, where I have other plants that I do like, how the heck do I get rid of this rose bush?
So is this perhaps a white flowering rose?
I don't even know. I don't let it get that far anymore.
You don't even let it get that far.
I cut it back to the roots, and then I try to dig it up. But somehow,
there's some roots that are, yes, and that's what's happening, is that it's probably like a multiflora rose is the one I was thinking of, which is an invasive species in Vermont. It sends out its rhizomes all over the place. So if you cut it all back.
I think this was planted by a previous homeowner.
It could have been a multiflora rose that was planted because, like a lot of the invasive plants, they were brought into this country with the intention of having them as an ornamental plant. Mm. And then they didn't realize what they got. So as far as taking care of it, you're doing a good job, Jane. Cut it back. Just keep cutting it back. Mow it down. Cut it back. Curse it.
I speak a lot of harsh words to it,
but it doesn't seem to do anything to get your frustrations out. Right.
I hear that actually speaking to your plants helps them grow, so maybe I should give it the silent
treatment. Depends on how you talk to them.
Oh, really? Good.
Oh, yeah.
Good, because I am speaking harshly. Marianne is calling in from Rutland. Marianne, hi. Go ahead.
Hola, Charlie. And Hola. Maria in Rutland.
Hi. How are you, Marianne?
Good.
Fellow traveler.
What's that?
A fellow traveler.
Fellow traveler on a great trip to Cuba.
Yes, thank you.
Moles and my compost. They love my finished compost. So when I do amend for transplants, the moles all come in tunneling. And they even tunnel in my finished compost on the ground. Mm-hmm. So what to do? And do they have any benefit, those moles?
Well, they're making tunnels, which is good for air spaces in the soil.
Right.
The moles are carnivores, so they're eating little soil creatures that are in your compost, which makes sense because that's what ends up happening when you make compost. You get a plethora of all kinds of creatures in there. They're not harmful to plants in and of themselves, but what they can do, especially in the garden, is they create the tunnels that then mice and voles will come through, and they're the ones who will eat the roots and the bulbs and all the other things in your garden. So it's kind of not a good idea to have too many tunnels in there because it's just opening the door to all these other creatures to come in. The way to get around it, Marianne, is to spray castor oil. And castor oil is something that you can get not at the grocery store but at a garden center. You don't want the one at the grocery store that's deodorized. You want something that smells.
Okay, good. So there's an agricultural castor oil.
Yes, exactly. And garden centers will have that. And you spray that around the area where the moles are active or areas you're afraid they're going to be active in. And that they hate the scent of it. And they'll just get very active. They'll get very nervous, you might say, tunneling all over, and then they'll go elsewhere. And it's a very safe way to kind of get them out without having to resort to any other kind of means.
Yeah. And does it have to be on the surface or?
Yes.
You spray on the surface?
Just on the surface is fine.
Okay.
Yeah, they'll catch
the scent.
That sounds
easy.
Yes, it is easy.
Easy is my favorite kind of
tip. We like those easy solutions.
Marianne, thanks.
Thanks, Marianne. Take care.
Deb wrote in to say, we have grow lights and we started a couple of red robin tomatoes in containers to grow indoors over the winter. They've already started to flower. Do we have hope of being able to actually harvest tomatoes this winter? We have a fan to help them pollinate.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, if you have grow lights, high-intensity grow lights is what you really need for any kind of fruiting plant indoors. And if she has the right lights that are regulated for this kind of growth, then she should be able to get them. You do have to pollinate them, as she understands. So, and simply with tomatoes, it's really easy. You just have to jiggle them or put a fan on them. They just need a little motion for the pollen to drop in and the fruit to get pollinated. It's pretty simple. And yes, you should be able to get some fruits. Now, I'm not going to guarantee flavor. That would be the other thing.
Yeah, why? Why not?
Well, because the grow lights are great, and you can get some nice quality fruit, but it's not the same as Mother Nature's sun. It's just not the same, in my opinion.
Well, we'll have to try them. Deb, if you grow them and
send them in, we'll eat them.
Or if you don't, I mean, we will definitely eat them if you send them in. But if you taste test them, I'd love to know. Maybe we can talk about it in the spring. We can read your email.
Good.
Yeah, we'd love to know what you think about the taste and quality and how it was to grow. Because also, it's obviously electricity intensive. So maybe you've got solar or some way to keep the costs down.
To keep the costs down. Yeah, it could be a very expensive cherry tomato.
Rick in East Dorset says, will potted strawberries left outdoors freeze?
Yes, they will.
And is that a problem?
Yes, it is. So what you should do with your potted strawberries is either bring them into a protected area. We've talked about basements and unheated garages, sheds, place where it's going to stay around freezing but not get too cold. Or you can heal them in. That's another thing you can do. You can do that with any potted plant. Say you went to a garden center and you bought the shrub of your dreams and you don't have time to plant it this fall for whatever reason. You can heal it into the soil or heal it into a mulch pile or a soil pile with leaving it in the pot.
So that's what heal it in means?
That's what healing in means. So he could take that whole container of strawberries, dig a hole, basically, pop it in there and bury it with soil.
Why would you do that instead of just planting it if you're already digging
well,
a hole?
Well, it's simpler than if you're going to keep it growing in that container in the spring.
If you might want to put it somewhere else or something.
Right. If you took all the plants out, put them in the soil, then had to put them back into the pot.
Got this way,
you just put the whole pot in the ground and just bury it. And that'll work.
Bury it all the way?
Yeah, bury it all the way. Sure. At the top, you don't want to bury it so deep that it's like buried a foot deep. But maybe at the top you put some bark mulch or something so that the leaves...
you can't see anything. It is totally under.
And you're going to do that with strawberries in the garden anyway. You'll see often farmers will put hay or straw down to protect them in the winter.
Let's go to Francis, who's calling in from Cambridge, New York. Hey, Francis.
Hi. Good morning. Or afternoon, actually. I've been working in an area I'm trying to clear for the spring, and it is overwhelmed with Virginia creeper. And I can cut it back or, you know, pull the long vines off. But I can't get the core of it. And even if I dug it a little bit with a shovel, all I'd be doing is making more runners. Is there something safe that I can put on it to kill the clump right there?
A caller after my own dreams, Charlie.
Yes.
Trying to kill things.
Yes, Virginia creeper is interesting because it's a native. It's a native vine that grows here, but it can, as she's saying, become very invasive. So it's a whole native invasive debate thing. A lot of people just like, if it's a native, it's good. If it's an exotic, it's bad. But it's a little murkier than that. So with Virginia creeper, it can kind of take over. And this time of year, you really notice it because it has the bright red leaves. And if you look in the forest and you see these bright red streaks going up trees, often it's Virginia creeper just turning that fall foliage
color.
Yeah,
which is so beautiful, though.
It's gorgeous. Yes, it is. But it can become too much and smother a tree, just like a kudzu would do further south, and kill plants. So to get rid of it, you've got the right idea. You have to cut it back, but go to the source. So go try to find out where the trunk is, where it's coming out of the ground, and cut it back there. And then as things sprout out, you just have to continually be on top of it. Now, if you can rip out that trunk, if it's not too thick and you can get in there, there are actual tools. There are one tool called the, I think it's called the ditch witch or the weed weasel.
You've got to say that carefully, Charlie.
The weed weasel, that's another one, which is meant for pulling out invasive trees and shrubs and vines. But you don't need to get a special tool, though. You could dig it out by hand. But it is worth making the effort to try to dig it out because the more you can dig out the root system, the less energy it'll have to send out those runners that she was talking about. You will have to come back for a number of years to stay on top of it. But if you're really diligent, you can actually clean it up.
And so there's nothing, no product that Francis could just put on that?
Well, she's asking about a safe product.
Yeah.
So there are chemicals, certainly, that you can use for poison ivy, Virginia creeper, lots of different vines, which can be applied. And if you do want to do that, there are a number of them out there. The way to do it is to paint it onto the stump after you cut it and then cover that over with like a little yogurt container or something so that it's not exposed. Kids and wildlife doesn't get exposed to the chemical. Then it translocates down into the root system and kills it. That would be effective. But it is using a chemical that would get into the soil.
Got it. Christine writes in to say, I had a high level of annoying pest problems this year, notably sawfly larvae, Japanese beetles, cabbage worms, and aphids. I didn't get around to cleaning up my garden last year, and I suspect that contributed to the problem. I'd love some advice about preventing these infestations. They always seem to begin just when I'm too busy to deal with it.
Yeah, isn't that ironic?
That feeling too. Yeah.
I know that feeling, yeah. Just going away on vacation like the tomato hornworms this
year.
Went away on vacation, there was no tomato hornworms. Came back, there were no tomatoes. was. Well,
yeah, they knew you were gone.
They knew I was gone. 5 days. Anyway, yes, that is a very frustrating thing. And all of those insects that she was mentioning are ones that will be here in more or less high population levels, depending upon the weather and the conditions. So this year may have just been a bad year. I have not had bad Japanese beetle years for a number of years now. Knock on wood. Is this wood? No, it's formica. Anyway, because I think what I did for a number of years is treated with beneficial nematodes. And we've often talked about that on these shows. It's a little late to do it for this fall, but you can certainly do it next spring.
That's my favorite band, by the way.
Beneficial Nematodes?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very good. Their top hit, of course, is Japanese beetle.
That's right. Yeah, but so, you know, what is someone to do when they go away and find all of these pests?
Well, yes. Yeah, so one solution isn't to never go away, to stay there. But the other, of course, is to grow a diversity of plants. Do all the basic good gardening practices. Rotate your crops. Grow different plants in different places. Look for resistant varieties, depending upon what it is, the insect is that you have. Cover things over. She mentioned cabbage worms. You can grow broccoli, you can grow kale, cabbages, all those under covers, under those floating row covers, or you can even get things like tulle at the fabric store, which is the stuff you made, you know, for tutus.
For tutus, yeah.
Yeah, you remember that when you were younger, running around in tulle. So that's a nice material to use, and it's pretty inexpensive. And just the idea is that you're covering it so that the adult can't lay the egg on the leaf. And I've done that for a number of years for some specific pests in the Champlain Valley, like the Swede midge and the leek moth, and it's worked really well. It's allowed me to grow those plants without having to think about spraying and being there to spray them, and the plants grow to maturity. So there's things like that that you can do. You can look for resistant varieties of squashes that don't get squash vine borer, for example. So doing a little research this winter, kind of thinking about your garden, think of what's important to you. What really matters?
And then do some soul searching.
Do a little soul searching in your garden. What do you really like to eat and grow? And stick with those plants and then kind of become like a specialist a little bit. You know, really do a little research and become the best butternut squash grower this side of the Rockies.
Hey, speaking of squash, let's go to Paul, who's calling in from West Chazy, New York. Hey, Paul.
Yes, hi. How are you? I have the last several years where we plant our winter squash by mid-August. It just starts to die back, and we've gotten half the yields that we've gotten in the past. It just turns moldy, and it just starts dying. And this year, we didn't plant any winter squash. We figured we'd give that spot a rest. What do you advise? Do you advise we try planting it in the same spot again next year, or do something different?
I would definitely try to plant it somewhere else if you have a big enough garden to rotate it around. My guess is it might be just powdery mildew that you're getting, which often happens in August to lots of plants, including squash plants and melon plants, everything in that family. And that's something that's just more of an environmental effect, meaning that the powdery mildew fungal disease is just ubiquitous. It's just out there. And under the right environmental conditions, then it starts taking off. But if you can plant it in a different location, separate the plants further apart so they have a little more airflow going around them. That might help doing that. And then look for some resistant varieties. I know there are varieties now they've worked on that have better tolerance to the mildews, downy mildew, powdery mildew, and those. So try a couple different varieties of your favorite squashes and see if that helps.
So David wrote in to say how and when to put our lawns to bed for the winter. Now, I don't do much to my lawn for the winter, so I don't know whether David means lawns or gardens, but what's your thought, Charlie, on
both?
Well,
yeah, usually lawns, you don't really have to put them to bed, per se. The one thing you could do, which is often recommended, is to mow them a last time, which would be around now.
We're also hearing advice not to mow them a last time. Let it be a little long. Let all the plants and animals that might need a little extra shelter and extra roughage have it.
So, yeah, the traditional thought is to mow it a little lower the last time, and that was only to prevent fungal diseases in the winter, because if you do have kind of a shaggy grass, it's really wet, it's really high in nitrogen, and then next spring you might get some fungal diseases, some different spots that are dead in your lawn. You wonder why. It could be due to that. But if that being said, if that's not been an issue in your lawn, then there is really no reason to really mow it tight. You can just let it grow a little higher, just let it sit there, and it'll be fine for the winter. There's really not much to do to it.
So what about putting our gardens to bed? I mean, that is it's perfect time to talk about that. I almost think maybe David was a plant you know, a different kind of plant. Maybe you said, David, write in and ask how we can put our gardens to bed for the winter. Yeah, but Charlie, what about it? Putting the garden to bed.
Yes. So putting the garden to bed. This kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier about not necessarily cutting everything back. And certainly one of the things that I've been a big advocate for, and actually I'm writing a book on it.
Excellent.
Oh, preview for 2020 on no dig gardening.
No dig. So we've done no till. Now we're in no dig.
Well, it's kind of like, yeah, gardeners, it's no dig. Farmers, it's no till.
The idea is that
you're not turning the soil. You're not digging it. You're not breaking sod. You're not doing all that backbreaking work. You're building up the soil like it should naturally be doing. But one of the things I often recommend and I do in our garden is instead of pulling things out, so you've got your tomatoes and your peppers and your squashes and whatever it is, and often the temptation is to go there and just rip it and just pull the root system out. That disturbs the soil. And what that does when you disturb the soil like that is that you're harming microorganisms that are in the soil. A better thing to do is use your hand pruners, or you can use loppers or hedge trimmers too, and cut it off at the soil line. So unless those plants had really serious root-borne diseases, like they had a wilt, for example, in the roots, then there's no need to be pulling that out. The nice thing about doing it this way is it's less work, which is a good thing. You're not disturbing the soil, and you're creating air and water channels in the soil as those roots decompose through the winter and into next spring. So the soil will have those channels ready and available for when you just pop in your new plants in the spring. Again, it's not that clean raised bed look that a lot of people like, that it has no rocks, no debris, no weeds, nothing in it. It's not that look. It's got a little messiness to it.
You're speaking my language.
But if you're okay with the messiness, it is actually a better way to grow plants. So next spring, say you had a tomato bed, you're going to come in and plant your lettuce there. You just kind of work around the little stumps. They'll eventually go away. They'll decompose in the summer, and you'll have a whole bed of lettuce that'll grow.
So do you think this is the pendulum sort of swinging back? I mean, for a while it was like, you know, some of these methods that you're talking about are old school methods, you know, an older way of gardening, an older way of thinking about your lawn, a less sort of labor intensive version, or at least a less chemical intensive, or less like everything needs to be pristine, and more of a way of working with your soil, with your landscape, to try to make your garden and your yard strong. I mean, do you see it that way? That it's
yes,
shifting back?
In some ways, I see it that way. I like to say shifting back, but also going forward, because there's other reasons.
We know the science behind it.
Yeah, we know more
now.
Of the science. You know, many years ago, farmers would have a home garden, and they didn't have a lot of time to take care of this home garden, whether it be flowers or vegetables, whatever it is. They would enjoy it. They'd get what they could out of it, but they didn't have time to cut things back and do all the things that are now recommended, especially with sprays and chemicals and fertilizers. So we kind of have come full circle in that sense that we're kind of doing the same kind of, I don't want to call it negligence, let's just call it
benign neglect.
Benign neglect. I like that better phrase. A benign neglect of that garden, but we're doing it for scientific reasons. We're realizing that having a balanced ecosystem in the soil and on top of that soil where all that debris is important, and it is just as important, if not more important, than what you're growing up there as far as flowers, fruits, and vegetables.
Yeah, you're a soil gardener as much as you are
a vegetable
gardener.
Soil gardener. That could be my other book.
I expect the royalties on that title. Rachel emailed in to say, can you leave your beets and carrots in the garden to winter over? If so, should I mulch it heavily? If not, what's the best way to store them?
Yes, you can. You can do it two ways. If you wanted to harvest them and store them indoors, you have to have the right conditions. That's the key. That's why root cellars were used often for a lot of these root crops, because they need a lot of that humidity that they'll have, and they need near freezing temperatures. Now, if you don't have those kind of situation in your basement or wherever you're living, you can leave them in the ground, and especially the carrots and the parsnips. The beets I've had a little hard time with. They seem to kind of turn into mush really quickly. But you do have to heavily mulch them, especially if you have them on a raised bed, because the raised bed is lifted off the soil. It's a little more exposed to the cold. So you want to get some hay bales or straw bales and pile it on, like a foot or two deep, kind of piling it on. You don't want to do it now, though. The reason is, if you do it now before the ground gets really cold, all the mice and the voles that are out there, they're going to say, I got a bed for the winter, and I've got dinner. So wait till November. Wait till we get into mid to end of November or so. It gets really cold before the ground freezes, of course, and then pile all that on there. And what you're trying to do is just keep the ground right around that freezing temperature, but it'll enable you to go out in January, February, and March, you dig through the snow and the mulch and pull out fresh roots, which is really fun.
So Diane says, I have three raised garden beds. In one, I planted zucchini, summer squash, and cucumber. After getting four beautiful zucchinis, the plant leaves wilted and died almost overnight. After doing some research, I assumed they had gotten killed by a vine borer. The summer squash went next. The cucumber plants in the same bed were fine. What's the best way to prevent this for next year? Even if I move the zucchini to another raised bed, how can I prevent this from happening again in a second bed?
So the squash and the winter and summer squash, both are susceptible to the vine borer, the squash vine borer, which is a fly that lays its egg right on the base of the plant, and the egg hatches into a caterpillar and this kind of tunnels through, eventually causing the plant to wilt. If you like butternut squash, like it a lot because the squash vine borer does not like it. And you can plant that and tends not to get that kind of problem. For the zucchinis, for other kinds of summer squash that you might have, that as far as I know, there aren't any resistant varieties. So you're going to have to do a little more active protection of them. So maybe before the plant is flowering, you can cover them with those materials we're talking about, the floating row covers or the tulle. And what that'll do is prevent the egg from being laid down on the base of the plant. But of course, once they start flowering, you're going to need to open it up so the bees can cross-pollinate. Then you just have to be very observant and watch. And you're looking right at the base of that plant and look for any kind of activity that looks like something's tunneling. And if it is tunneling in there, you can get on top of it really quickly by taking a razor and just slitting the stem out from where the hole is out towards the tip of the branch. And as you slit, chances are you're going to run into a big, fat, juicy white worm. And that's
fry
what that caterpillar.
Afterwards.
Fry it up. Something from Lion King, you know, like the Pumbaa. Mm,
yeah, slimy yet satisfying.
There you go.
That's the
good
line.
Quote.
Well, I have kids at the right
age
for that.
Yeah, that's right, right. You know.
So, Charlie, can you talk to us a little bit about forcing your bulbs in containers? So,
yes.
I mean, we were talking earlier about planting bulbs at this time of year, but mm-hmm. give us a little tip on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so one of the fun things to do is you can force bulbs in containers so you can have a beautiful flower show in the spring. This is especially good if you don't have a big yard. If you have just a small yard, maybe an apartment, a condo in town, whatever it is, but you want to have some spring flowering bulbs, you can plant them in a container, you can winter chill them, and then in the spring you have two choices. You can bring them indoors and have them force and come up, or you can wait till like April or May and put them outside and have them come up. The way to do it to maximize your forcing, you might say, is to get a fairly good size container, 16, 18 inch container, and get different size bulbs that bloom at different times. So maybe get an early daffodil, which is a big bulb, then maybe a mid-season tulip, which is kind of a medium-sized bulb, and then some scillas and crocuses and snowdrops, some smaller little bulbs. And you plant them at different depths in the same pot. So you put the big bulb on the bottom, maybe 6 inches deep, put some potting soil over it, put the tulips in there about 4 inches deep, put some soil over it, then put the little bulbs on the top only a couple inches deep. Give it a little bit of water, and then you want to put it in a place where it's going to get winter chilled, meaning it's going to have temperatures below 50 degrees for about 14 to 16 weeks. So if you do the quick math, here we are in mid-October, that's going to put you probably end of February, March. If you can put it in a cool place, it'll just sit there. You don't have to do anything to it. But if you put it in that cool place, it'll get the winter chilling that it needs to start flowering. And then at that point, say in early March, you can pull them out, put them up on a dining room table or a sunny window, warm place, and they'll start growing. And not only will they grow, you'll get the young bulbs coming up first and then the older bulbs coming later. So you get weeks of color from it. And you could do the same thing if you wanted to just wait a little longer and say in April or early May, put it outside and you can have it on your front stoop with this beautiful colorful bouquet of flower colors that people will be so impressed with.
Can you put it in a garage that sometimes gets freeze, you know,
well,
freezes?
Depends on how cold it gets. Mm. If it stays around freezing upper 20s, you're probably okay. If it gets below that, you might want to have to protect the container itself, wrapping it with blankets or something like that. That's going to just kind of keep it warm enough.
I just imagine there are a lot of people who have a place that kind of freezes sometimes,
yeah,
like a garage, and not a lot of places that are going to be chilled all the time.
Right. If you can put it in the warmest part of that garage or that shed or whatever you have, and protect it with blankets or hay or whatever it is, that'll help.
What about houseplants? I mean, this is the time of year when many of us want to start seeing more green when we're seeing less green, but a great way to do that is to have some wonderful houseplants. Any advice for getting those through the
yes,
winter?
Yes, houseplants are hot. It's like what all the millennials are doing. Everyone's got houseplants now. They're back. And what's great is that because there's a bigger demand now for houseplants, they're starting to breed these beautiful houseplants that can take very low light levels. I mean, literally like no window kind of light levels, have some colorful foliage foliage to them and not require a lot of watering. It's like, it's the perfect houseplant.
Wait, but so seriously, growing houseplants, having houseplants is on the rise?
Oh, yeah. It's been on the rise for a while.
I thought everybody just always did that, and those who didn't never did.
No. Among young people, especially urban folks who don't have room to grow things outdoors, houseplants are really hot. There's clubs, there's chat lines, there's all kinds of things going on where people are sharing plants and talking about their best plants. They're growing hundreds, literally hundreds of plants in their little loft in Brooklyn kind of thing.
Cool.
Because they like the aesthetic of having something growing around them. It cleans the air. It makes you feel good. You can talk to them. They don't talk back to you. It's great.
I want a growing wall.
Yes, a green wall. And that's another way to do it too. You can get kits that you can put those up in, or you can kind of create it yourself. It depends upon how sophisticated you want to get. But yes, and you see these green walls a lot of times. I saw one once in... I think it was in Queens, at a school. They put it up to help clean the air because it takes out a lot of toxins out of the air that were being emitted by the carpets and paint and things like that in the school. So growing houseplants is fun. It's really, there's a lot of selection out there. If you have a sunny spot, succulents are really cool to do. The agaves and echeverias and a number of different kinds of houseplants give you kind of that southwest look to it. You know, you could do something like that. You can get some nice big foliage houseplants, like I was mentioning, the Chinese evergreen is a nice one that's out now that has some reddish kind of coloring to its leaves. Doesn't require a lot of light or water. And you can get plants that are just, you can't even kill them. The ZZ plant is one that's like that. And there's another one called the mother-in-law's tongue, Sansevieria. It has this real spiky leaf that goes straight up and ends at a little point. Unfortunate for the mother-in-laws. There's a cactus called mother-in-law's pillow, too.
That sounds nicer, maybe.
I don't know.
Spiky. Yeah, maybe not. All right, let's leave that there.
Anyway.
What if it's your home that goes down into the 50s, maybe at night, you know, if you've got your plants downstairs and you're somebody who keeps your home pretty cool? I mean, houseplants sometimes have a hard time with that.
Yes. So certain houseplants are not going to like going below 50, for sure. So you want to keep those kinds of houseplants in a warm place. We're talking about subtropical and tropical plants that rarely even see 50 degrees. So you want to keep them in warm places. If you're really going to go in those kind of temperatures, some of the succulents would be a better choice because they're used to getting really cold in the desert.
All right. So, you know, we're going to probably have a little bit of time before we talk to you again, Charlie. Mm-hmm. So Corlin wrote in to say, I have mostly fall raspberries. When I checked pruning times this spring, I read that they should be pruned in February. What should I do? So give us some tips for, you know, November, December, January, February, April, May, June.
Yeah. Sure. Something like that. Well, with the raspberries that she has, the fall producing raspberries, you have two choices. You can prune them in the summer after the first crop, the primary crop, like in July, taking out those stems that have produced, and then let the fall crop happen. Or this time of year, after they're done, you can mow the whole thing down. You won't get a summer crop, but you get a bigger fall crop that way.
Okay.
So you can have maybe two rows, maybe one you mow down, one you don't. So you end up getting a bigger fall crop in that one you did mow down.
Anything else that we should just at least have in our mind to start thinking about for the colder months right now?
For the colder months, well, protecting things, protecting tender shrubs, tender trees, you know, using burlap is always a good idea, but don't let the burlap touch the leaves, especially if you have like rhododendrons, for example, because that's going to wick moisture away from them. So it's best to put in some stakes around the shrub and then wrap them with the burlap. It's often the cold winds that kill plants, even like roses, more so than the absolute cold temperatures. So blocking the wind is a good idea.
All right. Block the wind, protect yourself and protect your shrubs.
Yes.
Charlie Nardozzi is a gardening consultant and host of the Vermont Garden Journal at VPR. And we have a link to his website where you can get in-depth and personal gardening and landscaping help from Charlie at vpr.org. Charlie, as always, thank you so much. Always interesting.
Have a good fall.